The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler. Volume 4, The Medieval World. Episode 72, The Battle of Legnica. This episode's battle is the Battle of Legnica. It's sometimes referred to by its German name, the Battle of Liegnitz. Legnica is a city in modern-day Poland and in the west of the country. Its location is about 200 miles south of the Baltic Sea, and on the wider map of Europe, it's between the Elbe and the Vistula rivers, both of which drain into that same Baltic Sea. The river that actually flows through the middle of this region of Europe is called the Oder River, which also empties into the Baltic Sea. This area of Europe would have likely been settled by Germanic tribes since before the age of Jesus Christ, and was too far away from the Roman Empire's northern frontiers to be affected by their northward expansion. We can suggest that the Germanic peoples who were most likely to be living in this area of Europe were the Vandals. The Vandals were eventually displaced by the Huns in the 5th century, where they crossed the Rhine River into Gaul, leaving the area firmly within Hunnic territory. Hunnic domination of Central Europe was not long-lasting, and they lost their grip, being driven back east, and it was likely the Lombards who migrated southwards to occupy the lands vacated by the Vandals when they left the area. The Lombards were also a Germanic tribe who took the opportunity to migrate southwards to establish something more resemblant of a state in the Italian peninsula. The next tribes to migrate to the area were actually Slavic, and they would have come from the east to occupy the area since somewhat abandoned by Germanic tribes. Among those Slavic people who emerged in this area by the 8th century were the Moravians and the Bohemians. So this area has since represented a meeting of the Slavic and Germanic cultures to this very day, with the Slavic borderlands becoming the modern countries of Poland and Czech Republic, and the lands to the west belonging to Germany. Back in the beginning of the 9th century, none of those countries existed, as the lands were still tribal in nature. Despite this, it is believed through archaeology that a settlement existed near or at the modern city of Legnica from at least this period, if not earlier. A state called Great Moravia emerged to the south of this area and was probably centred on a Slavic area that had been established in the 7th century by a Frankish merchant called Samo. So we can suggest that the eastward expansion of the Franks had had a modernising influence on the area. Great Moravia was established in an area not unlike the much more modern country of Czechoslovakia. Control of these lands was often being disputed between the Moravians, the Bohemians, and the Hungarians. To the north of this area during the 10th century, the Eastern Franks had formed an independent state, which was the foundation of the modern concept of Germany. But it was known as the Holy Roman Empire and was attempting to expand its influence eastwards to the banks of the Oder River. But to the west of the Oder, a Slavic tribe called the Polans were establishing their own territory, which over time would come to be known as Poland.
Poland.
In the 12th century chronicle called Gesta Principum Polonorum, which is essentially a chronicle of the history of Poland, a man called Piast the Wheelwright is claimed to be the ancestor of the monarchs of Poland, and as such, his descendants are referred to as the Piast dynasty of monarchs. The first significant ruler of the Polish people was a man called Duke Mieszko. Mieszko made a great effort to bring together the various peoples of his locality. One of the first principal cities of Mieszko's area of influence was Gniezno, which is around 100 miles northeast of Legnica. Mieszko's expansions included the area known as Silesia, which contains the city of Legnica. So, during Mieszko's rule, during the late 10th century, the area around the city of Legnica was incorporated into the Polish sphere of influence. The establishment of the state of Poland was accepted by Western Europe after Mieszko was married to the Bohemian princess Dobrawa and his conversion to Christianity. By the end of his rule in the year 992, he had established a realm that stretched all the way to the Baltic Sea in the north. As a new Christian realm, most of Poland's actions were under the Holy Roman Empire's approval, but it would be under Duke Mieszko and Dobrawa's eldest son, Bolesław, that Poland would really create an identity for itself. Bolesław initially had to eliminate his internal political rivals before he would reunify Poland and actually stand against the Holy Roman Empire's authority, which would eventually put the Holy Roman Emperor, Otto III, into a position of recognising the independence of the Polish Church. It was the year 1025 when Bolesław was recognised as the first king of Poland and he was crowned, but he would die later in the same year. His legacy had been cemented though, and Poland was now an established European kingdom, and as such he is referred to as Bolesław the Great, but he is also commonly known as Bolesław the Brave. Life for the new kingdom of Poland after the death of Bolesław the Brave was hard, as it tried to survive in between the powerful entities of the Holy Roman Empire to its west and Kievan Rus to its east, and during the 12th century it devolved into a collection of duchies, a number of which were ruled by Piast dynasty dukes. The disintegration of Poland and the rivalry between its duchies allowed the Germanic entities to the west to infiltrate the Polish system and Germanize some of the lands and cities of the Polish western borderlands. Another threat to Polish territories entering into the 13th century was from the Old Prussians. The Old Prussians resided in lands along the banks of the Baltic Sea, but on the eastern side of the Vistula River. They were a tribal peoples who had not been Christianized, meaning that they were still pagan. Originally, the Polish had been attempting to invade Old Prussian territory, and the Pope had been sending missions to Old Prussia to convert them to Christianity. The Old Prussians resisted and started raiding Polish lands as a consequence, so the Polish called on the Order of the Teutonic Knights, a Christian military order, to assist them in their struggles with the Old Prussians. The Teutonic Knights settled in lands to the northeast of Poland, creating a buffer state between Poland and Old Prussia. But there would now be a much larger threat on the horizon.
The Mongol Empire.
The Mongols were a steppe culture and the peoples who provide the modern country of Mongolia with its name. Historians debate the precise emergence of the Mongol tribes, because nomadic cultures have existed on the steppe grasslands of Europe and Asia for many centuries and even millenniums. There's no evidence to suggest that these people had a routine method for distinguishing themselves from one another, as modern countries and nations do. And there's certainly no written history to describe their view of each other, as the only written history is written by outsiders from more developed states, and they only had limited knowledge and understanding of the steppe cultures. So to be able to specifically pinpoint the time when the Mongols were identifiable as the Mongols when compared to all of the other steppe tribes is difficult. Some historians suggest that they could have been to some degree distinct as early as the first millennium BCE. One distinguishing factor of the Mongols is that they spoke Mongolic languages, so linguists will also have an opinion about when their language became distinct. Archaeologists and DNA researchers will also have an opinion based on their knowledge. This is why it's so difficult to suggest a specific time period for their emergence. The traditional lands of the Mongols were occupied by tribes referred to as the Xiongnu at the beginning of the first millennium CE. Exactly what the relationship between the Xiongnu and the Mongols is debatable, as it's not obvious. Some scholars do suggest that the Xiongnu are ancestral to the Mongols, but there is no categorical evidence for this. We do know that the nomadic Xiongnu invaded the lands of the more developed Chinese cultures over 1,000 years before the Mongols would do the same. After the lands of the eastern steppe had been dominated by Xianbei, Turks and Uyghurs throughout the first millennium, many different ethnic tribes emerged in these lands, including the Mongols. The Mongols may have been under the influence of the Khitans when the Khitans established their own Chinese dynasty called the Liao dynasty during the 10th century. The Jurchens defeated the Khitans during the 12th century before heading south into the lands of central China, and this void in the landscape eventually would give the Mongols a theatre in which they could prosper at the expense of similar tribes along them on the steppe. The prosperity of the Mongols accelerated under the guidance of a great leader called Chinggis Khan. Chinggis Khan would lead the Mongols to subjugate the many different ethnic tribes of the eastern steppe and create one great polity to the north of the Chinese dynasties. After he had successfully achieved this, he would look to the south and the established states, most of which were based on Chinese political systems. After taking a large portion of territory from the Jurchens, who were one of the Sinicized peoples to the south, the Mongols expanded rapidly westwards across Central Asia. The death of Chinggis Khan in 1227 did not prevent the Mongols' westward ambitions as they approached Europe.
Henry II.
Henry II, also known as Henry the Pious, was born in 1196, around 5 years before his father Henry the Bearded became the Duke of Silesia. The young Henry's brothers died while young, leaving him to be the sole heir of his father's possession, the land of Lower Silesia. His father had attempted to remain neutral in the conflicts between the duchies of Poland and the polities of the Holy Roman Empire, and he would betroth the young Henry to a Bohemian princess called Anne in an attempt to build a political bond. As an adult, Henry the Pious was very quickly prepared to become his father's heir, and on those occasions where his father was unwell or being held captive by an enemy, the young Henry would step in and act as his father's regent. In this highly competitive environment, it was not possible to remain neutral or allow your potential enemies the freedom to manoeuvre without taking action to prevent them taking a superior position. Therefore, both Henry the Bearded and Henry the Pious found themselves campaigning regularly. In the year 1234, Henry the Bearded declared that his son, Henry the Pious, would rule alongside him as his co-ruler. By this time, the campaigns of the two Henrys, father and son, had done much to unite a number of duchies. So it could have been for these reasons that the elder Henry elevated the status of his son, perhaps to help defend the territories. Henry the Bearded was now considered to be the High Duke of Poland. Henry the Bearded was also becoming quite elderly in the 1230s, maybe entering his 70s, so this could also be a factor in his motivations to move his son into a ruling position. Inevitably, the elder Henry passed away in the year 1238, leaving Henry the Pious to become the new High Duke of Poland in his father's place. Not only did Henry the Pious inherit his father's realms, but he also inherited his father's headaches. Many of the neighbouring dukes were making political manoeuvres against each other and against Henry himself, so Duke Henry II, the Pious, had to engage very quickly in the games of diplomacy, not only with his geographical neighbours, but also with the Church and the Pope. However, this political situation was interrupted by the sudden emergence of the Mongols to the east.
Mongol commanders.
After the death of Genghis Khan, one of his sons, called Ugudi, became the new Great Khan of the Mongol Empire. Ugudi Khan had ambitions of expanding westward from the lands that had been under the control of his older brother Jochi. Jochi had died just before his father Genghis, so Ugudi entrusted the western lands to one of Jochi's sons called Batu. Batu Khan was eager for the challenge and was afforded a force that was maybe around 130,000 men strong. Not only was Batu Khan afforded this great army, but also one of the greatest military generals of the Mongols called Sebedi. Sebedi had served under Genghis Khan in some of his key campaigns, but had built a reputation for being successful and strategical. Sebedi's posting to the western lands was as much as an advisor as it was an active military general, and although he was not physically active at this particular Battle of Legnica, he was very much a part of its strategy. With Sebedi by his side, Batu Khan could feel even more confident of success in the west. The first of what we might call European enemies were the Rus, who had once been part of the state of Kievan Rus, but were now somewhat fragmented, not unlike what had happened in Poland. The Rus were familiar with the Mongols as they had been attacked by them during Genghis Khan's lifetime, but now the Mongol aim was complete conquest. With the Rus, disunity being a detrimental factor, Batu Khan's forces took control of the lands of the Rus, which brought the Mongols into close contact with the states of Hungary and Poland. The next target for Batu Khan would be Hungary, but the Hungarians had converted to Christianity back in the 10th century, so the Mongols would have to be prepared for Christendom to call a crusade against them if they chose to attack, and this would include the lands of Poland. The Polish army were likely to spring into action in defence of the Hungarians should the Hungarians be attacked by the Mongols. So by sending a force into Poland, Batu Khan would be preventing the Hungarian army from receiving support and enabling a route into Hungary that the Hungarians may not have been anticipating. With Batu Khan concentrating on taking a force into Hungary, he needed to send a reliable and capable force into Poland, and this force may have been under the command of three individuals. Batu Khan had an older brother called Order Ichen. Order Ichen became more commonly known as Order Khan because he had been entrusted with the command of what has been called the left wing, also known as the White Horde, who themselves were a part of the Golden Horde. the White Horde would govern the easternmost lands of the Golden Horde to the east of the Caspian Sea, but Ordokhan was required to travel west and meet up with the diversionary force. Ordokhan would be joined by two of his cousins for the invasion. The first of the cousins was a son of the great Khan, Ugudi Khan, and his name was Kardan. The second cousin was a son of Chardai Khan called Baidar.
Prelude to the battle.
The foundation for Batu Khan's invasion of Hungary was based on the fact that King Bela IV, who was the king of Hungary and also of Croatia, had been harbouring and Christianising refugees of other Mongol invasions. Bela's motivation would be that he could bolster his own military forces with these refugees, and he would gain recognition from the Pope for furthering the Christian influence. This was something that the Mongols could use against the Hungarians to justify the invasion. Batu Khan had actually spent the past few years advising King Bela to surrender to him, so it appears that Batu Khan was more hungry to be in control of the great Hungarian plain than worry about repatriating or punishing the refugees. The refugees were from the conquered lands of the Rus, and also included Cumans from the Kipchak Khanate, which had been previously conquered by the Mongols. As mentioned before, Batu Khan was concerned that the Polish would come to the aid of the Hungarians, so he would split his forces into two. The main force intended for Hungary would be headed by Batu Khan and the great military general Szebedi. The diversionary force intended for Poland would be headed by Batu's cousins, Kardan and Baida, and Batu's older brother, Ordokhan. Szebedi would be the man behind strategising the Polish campaign, despite him physically being on the Hungarian campaign. The diversionary force would enter the lands of northern Poland and start ravaging the territory. Initially, the Mongols entered Poland during the winter so that they could cross the rivers while they were frozen. They would then move towards the south of the Polish territories and take city after city, moving deeper and deeper into European territory. The cities of Lublin, then Sandomierz, and then Kraków fell to the Mongols. For those of you familiar with the Polish city of Kraków, you will likely know of the bugle call that is sounded from a tower of St. Mary's Basilica each and every hour by seven of the city's firefighters. The bugle call, called the Hainau, is an incomplete melody, and it is said to be incomplete because it represents the same bugle call that the watchman of the tower performed in 1241 to warn the city of the Mongols' invasion. The watchman didn't complete the melody because he was struck through the neck by the arrow of a Mongol archer, and this lack of completion is mimicked by the firefighters of Kraków to this day. Contrary to some recounts of the story, the lone watchman bugler did not save the city from its destruction at the hands of the Mongols. Such was the devastation caused by the Mongols that the citizens of Wrocław, which was yet deeper into Europe, destroyed their own city and retreated rather than risk what they may have viewed to be a futile defence of their city and the likely massacre of their population. Duke Henry II of Silesia was ready for battle, though, with his Polish army. As ever, we see a difference in the estimated army size when reading different sources, but we believe that the Polish army outnumbered the Mongol diversionary force army, but not by as many as some sources would have us believe. I have seen numbers of around 25 to 30,000 that appear to be more realistic than claims of 100,000. There have also been some overestimations of the Mongol army, but we have to be realistic about the fact that this was a detachment of the main army, which was now heading into Hungary. So a sensible guess for the Mongol army may be around 20,000. The Polish army would have been bolstered by members of the Christian military orders of the period. The most well-known of these orders were the Knights Templar, the Knights Hospitaller, and the Teutonic Knights. It is suggested in some sources that members of all three orders gathered to help Henry defend Christendom, but doubts have been cast by other historians as to whether any more than a few dozen members of the Knights Templar were actually there for the battle. It could be realistic to suggest that many members of the Polish army were not trained soldiers, but instead people of the land carrying the most dangerous makeshift weapon that they could lay their hands on. The Mongols would, of course, have their horse archers that had made them so effective on the battlefield on so many occasions already. Their speed and skill was likely unparalleled, and often gave the Mongol armies the edge, even when they were outnumbered. It is certainly worth mentioning Mongol battle tactics as well. As we have seen from previous episodes, the Mongols had great expertise in communication on the battlefield, using flag systems from higher ground that gave them a greater communication speed throughout their vast army, and faster than their opponents. As Duke Henry approached the battlefield, he would split his army into four sections. The vanguard contained the Knights Templar alongside other elite German knights. Their numbers were bolstered by Polish and Moravian levies and miners. On the right flank were cavalry under the command of a Polish knight called Sulisław of Kraków. The left flank of the cavalry were under the command of the Duke Mieszko II, the Duke of Opole-Ratzeburz, and also known as Mieszko the Fat. The Grand Duke Henry commanded the forces at the rear, which contained both cavalry and infantry. The Mongol army was made up of heavy cavalry in the centre and light cavalry on the flanks.
The Battle of Legnica.
The first exchanges were entirely predictable given the Mongols' success in battles previously. Duke Henry intended to engage the centre of the Mongol army, so he sent his vanguard forward. But, of course, the Mongol armies unleashed their expert archers on the approaching knights. This was a total disaster for the Polish-led army, and they had to retreat due to the fact that they were losing numbers quickly thanks to this naive advance. Duke Henry changed his tactics and decided that it would be better to order his flanks under the command of Sulisław and Duke Mieszko the Fat to attack instead. But the issue with this was, as they approached the Mongol vanguard, the light cavalry of the Mongols was able to surround them, leaving the flanks of the main Polish army exposed. The Mongol vanguard actually retreated in order to draw the Polish flanks in further. And it was at this point that the Mongol light cavalry was able to manoeuvre behind the Polish flanks, which would cause chaos in the Polish ranks. There is a report that one of the Mongol horsemen shouted the word "run" in Polish, and so some of the Polish cavalry that were under the command of Mieszko the Fat started retreating, further adding to the disruption of their organisation. With Duke Henry witnessing the failure of his vanguard and then in turn his flanks, he had to make the decision to advance the rearguard under his own command. The Mongols retreated again, drawing the Polish forward and possibly leading Duke Henry to believe that he was achieving some sort of advantage. Once again, the Mongols were drawing the Polish into a trap. The Mongols had gathered large piles of reeds on the centre of the battlefield, and as the Mongols retreated, they set the reeds ablaze, creating a large wall of smoke that would further disorientate the Polish army. The Mongol archers were on hand to exploit the situation. They didn't need to see the individual Polish soldiers and horsemen. They only needed to rain arrows down in their general direction. The Polish army had advanced into a vulnerable position, while the flanks of the Mongol army continued to surround the Polish army, preventing any kind of systematic retreat. Mieszko the Fat had been fooled into a retreat by the Mongol horsemen, and he was unable to help his comrades, including Duke Henry, who had advanced into the fray. All Mieszko could do was either watch as the rest of the Polish army was slaughtered, or abandon them so that he could fight another day. The opposite flank commander, Sulisław of Kraków, was slaughtered in the battle. Grand Duke Henry II the Pious bravely tried to fight his way out of the Mongol trap. While attempting to break out, he was struck in the arm by a spear and subsequently beheaded.
Aftermath.
The Mongols attempted to slice the right ear from each of the killed Europeans, but the ultimate trophy of the battle was the head of the Grand Duke Henry II. The head would be put on a spike and paraded around the town of Legnica as a reminder to the population that the Mongols could not be defeated, so any kind of rebellion was futile. After success at Legnica, and just 2 days later, one main force of the Mongols led by Batu Khan and Subede engaged in battle with the Hungarians under their king Bela IV at the Battle of Möhi. Using clever tactics, horse archers and explosives, the Mongols defeated the Hungarians, laid waste to the city of Pest and destroyed the Hungarian Royal Army while taking control of the Great Hungarian Plain. The Mongols were conquering Europe piece by piece. The next target would be the lands of Austria, and the Mongols would scout the lands and the cities of the area. The great Christian leaders would not know exactly what to do. There had been very little in the way of solidarity between the Holy Roman Emperor and the Pope, and traditional kingdoms of the West, such as France and England, rarely saw eye to eye. The weakness of one entity could often be the benefit of another. So the question was, should Christendom stick together, or would there be long-term benefits to supporting the Mongols? Calls for crusades against the Mongols were not answered with the same readiness as those called in years gone by, and there was now a real danger that if the Mongols could manage their supply lines well enough, that Western European lands were now under genuine threat. The death of the great Khan, a goodie, would prove to be the salvation of Europe. Batu Khan would need to be involved in influencing the succession and maintaining the security of his own possessions, and so therefore he would need to withdraw completely from Europe. This left King Bela IV of Hungary to return to his destroyed kingdom after being run out of it. The Mongols would never invade Europe again with anything like this level of impact. If the great Khan, Ogude, had not passed away when he did, we can only speculate exactly how much of Europe the Mongols could have taken control of. Their heartless treatment of the populations and their disregard for anything sacred meant that they could not be reasoned with when total conquest was on their agenda. The impact of the Mongol invasion of Europe utterly devastated the principalities of the Rus and Hungary, but the recovering future generations would benefit from the influence of the Mongols on the lands from west to east as trade was able to flourish, which not only benefited the lands of the Mongol origin in the east, but also European lands in the west. So we are looking for the biggest positive for Europe in this devastating episode in history. Poland recovered quite well from the Mongol invasion, and it's possible to suggest that the Mongol invasion brought some much-needed solidarity to some of the political divisions of Poland, and Poland was able to stand up for itself as the Golden Horde started to experience some internal division of its own. Lithuania would also grow as a power during this period, and they would also benefit from the weakening of the Golden Horde. The Rus' Principality of Moscow grew in power from within the lands of the Golden Horde and would compromise the Golden Horde from within. Eventually, the Golden Horde would continue to dwindle away and then cease from existence by the early 16th century. Thank you very much for listening to this week's podcast on the Battle of Legnica. Thank you so much. And if you enjoy this podcast and you'd like to support it, then do by all means visit our website, click on the Patreon link, sign up to make a monthly contribution. You will become a lifelong member of the History of the World podcast Illuminati, and you'll qualify for gifts and rewards. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, drop me a line at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. You can follow the podcast on social media on Facebook, X, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Tumblr, Threads and Mastodon. And if you can't get enough of the podcast, then look out for a special debrief episode coming up very soon. So just alongside this one, where I'll be talking to you some more about the episode that you just listened to, and a few extra bits and pieces besides. So go ahead, go and listen to that. But that's all for this week. Thank you so much for listening. Next time, we'll be looking at the Battle of Ain Jalut between the Mamluks and the Ilkhanate. So that will be our next episode. And that will be in a couple of weeks' time. But until then, thanks for listening. Don't forget to go and listen to the debrief episode now, and be good.
The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler. Please consider making a financial contribution by going to the historyoftheworldpodcast.com website and clicking on the Patreon link. Email the show at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. And don't forget to join our social media at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and see you next time.